has been said, Todd's a newcomer.
Yeah.
And obviously, he's such a newcomer that he doesn't know the way behavior-based safety started.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I am your host for today. Oh, yes, I am. You can try to pull it away from me. You can try to pull this microphone from my cold, dead fingers, but you won't be able to do it because, one, you're not here, so that'll make it really hard to do. And two is by the time you hear this, I'll be thinking about other stuff. Okay, today's podcast is by special request. Big thanks to the ASSE, the American Society of Safety Engineers, and their 2017 summer meeting in Denver. They did a little session, some kind of session on the Wednesday in the middle of the conference. It was 1 hour long, and it was Scott Geller and Todd Conklin, and then a couple corporate people, all led by the guidance of Tom Krause, discussing the difference between the traditional view, behavioral-based safety view, and the new view, human performance, or they call it HOP a lot. These guys are HOP people. So it's a classic behavioral-centric, workers the problem versus the new view, workers the solution. And I've gotten about 50 billion requests to do this, so I'm just going to do it. I'll probably get in trouble. I don't know. Who knows what will happen. But this is a audio copy of that debate. I'm not going to talk much longer because it's long. Sit back and relax. Sorry the time, but that's how long this was. I think you'll find it interesting. I'm super interested in your comments. This, my friends, is Geller v. Conklin, 2017 ASSE meeting, Denver, Colorado.
So our first panelist is Scott Geller. And Scott is a senior partner at Safety Performance Solutions. Most of you know him and have heard him speak. He's been out there as a prominent spokesperson for the behavior-based approach to safety for the last 40-some years. He's written a ton of books. He's written articles. He has spoken all over the world. He has published in academic journals as well as safety journals. He teaches at Virginia Tech. He is a fabulous speaker and a terrific spokesperson for behavioral approaches to safety. Please welcome Scott Geller.
I should have sent him a big bow. Give him a dollar.
Our second panelist is Todd Conklin. And Todd is newer on the scene. He is one of a handful of experts in the country on human and organizational performance, HOP. Todd came up through Los Alamos Labs, where he was a senior advisor for NEHS for 25 years. He has written several books. He has done a number of really interesting podcasts. He has a PhD in organizational behavior. He is interesting, provocative, and lively. And I think you will enjoy hearing Todd Conklin's view of the issues we're going to talk about. If you haven't read his books or listened to his podcast, I suggest that you should. That they're really good and they're really interesting. I don't agree with Todd on everything. Nevertheless, his stuff is really worthy, and who knows, he might be right about something occasionally.
Provocative.
Yeah, and provocative. Please welcome Todd Conklin.
Thanks, you guys.
Our third panelist is Eric Grunke. Eric is a corporate safety director for Kiewit Construction, which is a very interesting company, 130 years old, as I understand it, 30,000 employees, more than $12 billion in revenue. They've been working on behavioral approaches to safety for the last 10 years or so, and they've worked extensively with Scott. So Eric will bring us a kind of inside view of what his experience has been over an extended period of time. And our please welcome Eric Grunke. And our fourth panelist is Kurt Kruger. Kurt is the global manager of health and safety programs for General Electric, which is a giant organization, over $100 billion in revenue, and over 400,000 employees and contractors worldwide. So it's an amazing company. They have taken on the human and organizational performance, the HOP approach, over a period of years recently. Kurt has been right in the middle of that. GE has also used behavioral approaches over the years. And so Kurt is uniquely positioned to have a viewpoint from the inside of a giant, highly successful organization with respect to safety and everything else. Please welcome Kurt Krueger. So I'd like to start our conversation with a question for Todd Conklin. So, Todd, quite a few of the people in our audience have a limited understanding or perhaps even not any understanding of HOP. Can you tell us what is HOP and how is it different than behavioral safety?
Well, sure. So, interestingly enough, what to call it is kind of a dilemma. So human performance, human and organizational performance, new view, safety differently, these are all terms that you guys are probably seeing and kind of delving into at least gently. It's really a shift in thinking. And if I were to sort of boil it down to one thing, the shift is how we perceive the worker. Whereas behavioral-based safety really sees the worker as the problem to be fixed. So we'll go out and observe the worker, we'll coach and counsel the worker, and we'll fix the worker. The new view of safety really sees the employee not as the problem to be fixed, but as a problem solver. And the shift in thinking, which I really want to invite you guys, at least for this hour, to sort of chew on, is that new view, that new understanding of the role of the employee changes everything we do. Because if you see the employee as an asset, as a problem solver, then you don't want to constrain the employee. You don't want to tell them what they should do or what they shouldn't do, what's a safe act and what's an at-risk act. You actually want to ask them what they need in order to solve the problem. And then ultimately, where this takes you is kind of a redefinition of what safety success is. Human performance on its face has said our traditional approach to safety success is outcome-based and kind of wrong. We see safety as the absence of accidents, when in fact the new approach sees safety not as an outcome, but as a capacity. Your facilities are not inherently safe. Sorry, I don't want to break it to you. I don't want to screw up your Wednesday. People create safety in your facilities. And that shift from seeing the worker as the problem to seeing the worker as the solution, I think it's maybe the starting place to talk about this new definition of how safety works worldwide.
I got to enter this. As has been said, Todd's a newcomer.
Yeah.
And obviously he's such a newcomer that he doesn't know the way behavior-based safety started years ago.
I wasn't born yet.
Exactly. So behavior-based safety, as originally and still taught, considers the worker part of fixing the problem, not the problem, but the solution. In fact, behavior is an input. Performance is the output of the system. And into that system goes behavior, goes person states, goes attitudes, goes all kinds of factors. So the way behavior-based safety was originally formulated, and sometimes people misinterpreted it and took it off and they wanted a quick fix. They wanted a quick fix. We're just going to count up people's behaviors. And some consultants sold behavior-based safety as the worker is the problem, the behavior is a problem. And we had United Steelworkers complaining, you had UAW complaining, can't blame them. But behavior-based safety from behavioral science was never that way. Behavioral science says that behavior is part of the system and the performance is the output of that. Dr. Deming taught me that. Performance is the outcome of the system and behavior is part of the input.
But the high reliability people, so go Sutcliffe, go Wyke, if we want to go on the academic level, they will tell you that behavior is actually the output of the system, that the system actually creates the behavior. Behavior doesn't create the system creates the behavior. And that contemporary research, the scholarly research that's being done now on organizations that are highly reliable, tend to not count on worker behavior. They tend to count on creating a robust and resilient system that has the ability to fail and recover and learn. And the interesting thing about that is that pushes us away from seeing behavior as a tool to impact the system, but sees behavior as an output of a system that creates reliability.
So, Eric, within your organization, is this an issue? Do your leaders see? And let me preface my question. Sorry. I've been doing a lot of work interviewing senior executives about safety in the last couple of years, and one of the things that I come across repeatedly in virtually each organization that I have done this in is a kind of knee-jerk reaction thinking of the senior leader that the worker is the problem. So the typical scenario is, there was a fatality. The worker got into the equipment without locking it out. The equipment started. It was a fatality. And the senior leader says, what was that person thinking? How could they have done that? Suggesting that it was a behavioral issue. Now, when we look at those events more carefully and we look at what happened, we see all sorts of system factors that come into play that impinged on that behavior. The worker was under time pressure. The machine had not been maintained at the proper level. There were all sorts of things pushing on the worker. In one case that I worked on, the worker was a contractor, and the contracting facility, this was in Asia, had their compensation set so that if the worker had an injury, they got fined. They got less money as a result. Wow. So, I mean, there are all sorts of influences that are coming in. So although it wasn't the intention of the behavioral people, and I was one of them earlier days, it wasn't our intention to create a blame-the-employee behavior issue, that the behavior is the problem. It happened anyway, and it's still out there in my experience. So that's the context. In your organization, do you see that?
You know, I think you described exactly where we were about 10 years ago. And, you know, as you brought that up, I was kind of laughing to myself about calling up my safety directors after they've had an incident and asking them, you know, those same questions about why do you think he did it, and them not being able to answer because they'd already fired the guy before they had a chance to interview him and find out what the real situation was. And so, we've evolved from there since then. And I was kind of laughing about this whole human performance, you know, understanding what are we talking about here. And in fact, we're actually doing some of that right now, you know, not even knowing what it was called. And, really where we've changed the most over the last 10 years is really making our craft employees our partners in this and having them become, you know, we started off with craft involvement. We moved over to craft engagement because involving them wasn't quite enough. And now we call it craft ownership. And it's really looking at them as partners and, like you talked about, problem solvers.
Yeah.
They're much better at this than we were. And we're getting so much better at our safety performance now because of the partnership that we have with our employees.
Kurt, what's your experience on this issue?
Similar. I mean, it's been some years since GE used behavior-based safety in any kind of a formal sense. But the experience we had at that time tended to play into something that our managers, let's face it, they learned from us. They learned in their management school training, you know, if you can control the behavior, you can solve the problem. And you can get quick hit improvements if you do that. So I'm not arguing with either Todd or Scott here at this point, but our experience was it kind of played into that tendency on the part of managers, if you're not very careful about how you manage it. What we found is an advantage in human and organizational performance really was if I recall, Todd, it involved a couple of beers in a bar and a conversation about local rationality.
And my shirt was off.
Yeah.
I look good.
TMI. Sorry about that. TMI. But what really kind of helped make it makes sense in my mind, was the local rationality principle. That the people that we hire are fundamentally rational people. They make decisions, some very conscious and some a little more automatic than others, but they fundamentally make rational decisions. They make sense to them in the time and the context in which they have to make that decision and perform that action. And if we stop at the level of the employee, then what Hop has helped us do is learn there's almost always a deeper story. It's those context conditions, the conditions they faced, the influences of the organization, and how they affected the employee's thinking at the time that they had to make that decision. So we've found that that has really helped us really speak almost to the management team and say, look, there's a deeper story here. And probably 99% of the time, there's a deeper story. If we don't learn that deeper story, you can get quick hit improvements. And that was our experience in the past, where we'd see improvements, but then they would tend to fall back. So we weren't able to sustain the improvements. So far, we feel like we're able to do that using HOP principles. And the partnership with employees is incredibly valuable. Maybe a comparison point. Anybody out there that's involved in VPP probably knows that GE's fairly heavily invested in VPP through OSHA. And one of the strongest points of that program is it requires you to create a partnership with your employees. I mean, that's what it's based on. And we thought it was great. And an interesting reaction on our part was when we got HOP principles introduced and we started using those practices at sites that were already VPP sites, those sites came back and they said, we thought we had a wonderful relationship with our employees. But when we implemented HOP principles, it went to another level of depth. Really powerful. So for us, yeah.
Thank you. We have some interesting questions coming in from the audience. Here's one. How do you address critics who say BBS programs are not sustainable over the long term? Eric, what do you think about that?
Within our organization, any program we try to execute around safety is sustainable if the management and the leadership feels like it's going to be successful and then push it the right way.
Has yours been sustainable?
It has. In our business units that actually believe in what they're doing, we have a long history of doing observation, intervention type of situations and getting not only getting good information out of them, but getting good behavioral change around them and really driving that climate of trust on the job sites where people feel like they can speak up and they can bring issues to the forefront so we can start working on them and not worried about who's going to get in trouble about who did what.
Scott?
See, well, his folks understand the principles. If you understand the principles behind it, then you understand the rationale. And they understand how do you sustain it? You keep it, it evolves. Take that simple behavioral checklist, which is still a good tool if it's used correctly. It has to be modified. It has to evolve. And it has to involve not only the employee, but managers in developing this checklist of behaviors that we need to pay attention to, but it has to evolve. And if the employees understand the principles and they're involved in the change, that'll sustain it. One of the principles we teach is self-motivation. How do you keep the worker self-motivated? And of course, there are ways to do that. I'll just three words: choice, competence, and community. People feel a sense of choice in their involvement, if they feel that they're good at something, they're competent, and there's a sense of interdependent community, they will develop self-motivation.
So, Scott, take this example. So the one that I gave. So a worker is killed. The worker did not follow the lockout tagout procedure. You're talking to a senior executive in that organization, and he says to you, and I'll ask this of everybody, but start with you if you'd like to address it. He says to you, what was that guy thinking? I mean, how could he have done that? What do you say to him?
I would say behavior does not occur in a vacuum. There's a context. I would ask them, how many other people performed the same at-risk behavior at your organization? To what extent was that the social norm at your organization? To what extent do you have a mindset of actively caring, where people are looking out for each other? Maybe he didn't tie off and somebody saw it, but they didn't say something. So it is about, I would ask him, what kind of culture do you have that would support or allow that kind of at-risk behavior.
Would you want them to look at the maintenance records of that machine?
Absolutely.
See if they've been followed?
Absolutely. Sure. But I want to look at everything that went into. I want a fact-finding, not a fault-finding. I want a fact-finding analysis. And I want to try to understand, just like Todd wants to understand, the system. What about the system allowed that to happen? And thinking was part of it. What was he thinking? I want to know that too. Unfortunately, he passed away. But when we have at-risk behavior, I want to ask the person, what were you thinking? I want to have the kind of environment where people are willing to talk about what they were thinking.
But if
people,
I may.
Please.
That assumes at-risk behavior is a choice.
Say it again. I didn't hear you.
That assumes at-risk behavior is a choice. And I don't know if I have the answer or if I don't have the answer. But my guess is if it were a choice, failing to lock out means I die. My guess is the worker probably would have said, not that interested in dying, probably going to lock out. I would actually suggest prima facie, and this is what worries me about words like safety culture and actively caring, is that I'm not sure caring more makes you safer, because I'm not sure a lack of caring causes accidents. In fact, lots of accidents that I see, the workers seem to care. They seem to care kind of a lot. They cared about production. They cared about deadlines. They cared about keeping their coworkers happy. There was a lot of engagement around this notion of caring. I think we have to do something different. I think we've been telling people when an event happens, look down and in. When in fact, I would suggest for your guys' company, when an event happens, I want you to look up and out. Blaming a worker for dying because they didn't care enough.
What do you blame the worker?
That's malpractice. That's wrong. Because I would suggest what we have to ask is a much richer question. Instead of telling workers what to do, let's ask workers what they need. Let's help them be successful in really creating this idea of safety as a capacity. That's where I would stand on that.
Tom, I'm going to say kind of the same thing that Scott did, but when I ask those questions, the first thing I ask is, you think it's the first time that guy did that? And the second question is, how in the world did he feel like it was okay for him to do that? Which is what I think you were kind of getting at, right? Is it this idea of you have a choice of whether or not to lock out?
I don't think you have a choice. I don't think it's a choice.
Well, yes. I think that you have a choice, but I think that there's a lot of pressures on you, and there's also a lot of experiences. Where if this is an employee that has gone and done the same operation time and time again without following the proper procedure, he kind of decides after a while that it's okay to do it that way. Even though we may have already told
but
him
it, to is that a choice? Because when you say choice, that means he purposely didn't choose the right way to choose the wrong way.
And there are factors in this individual's environment that influence that choice.
Does that mean it's not a choice? If there are strong factors, I'm pretty sure I
wouldn't. Like get down to there's no such thing as choice.
Maybe that's what I'm saying.
But leave that for now, because people do perceive they have choice.
But it doesn't make it right.
By the way, do you choose to use the word accident? Can you choose to avoid that word? And this is why.
So I use conventions.
An accident is something you can't control.
Right.
And you're into controlling the factors that influence injuries. So whenever you use the word accident, you are influencing, the culture.
Two things. One is, you don't get to tell me what I'm doing. We're having a discussion, so don't tell me what I'm doing.
That's a good
point. I would actually suggest that this notion of accident, event, incident, whatever you want to call it, it's a deviation from an expected outcome, right? Now, how we choose to call it really draws attention to the fact that we're asking a fundamental question, and that is, does the worker exercise free agency in our organizations, or is the worker part of a larger system that actually helps determine behavior? And when you say choice, it's really clean, because it helps us as an organization say, had the worker made a better choice, we'd had a different outcome. That's always true. It's always going to be true, but it's incredibly incomplete. And my goal is to not really understand what happened. I'm not worried about solving the last accident. I'm worried about thinking about the next potential accident. I want to look forward from that and learn and improve.
So
use the word accident again.
But I don't think the word accident.
Because
word,
Todd, I'm
I think you value
about,
the
I'm
word accident differently
let me,
than
me interrupt,
I do.
Let me interrupt you for just a second.
I just want to say one thing. I'm concerned about the language we use. If we're trying to influence the factors that you want to say that influence choice or no choice, I want to watch our language. Because I know from research that when people perceive they have choice, they're more likely to be self-motivated. That's all. So you might sit back as a behavioral scientist. I know my colleagues say there's no such thing as choice. We're totally controlled by the system. I care about what people perceive.
So how are we doing so far? You doing all right? Okay. Thank you. Thank you. There's no blood up here.
Not yet.
I can't see any. So
we got a half hour. Just calm down.
So far, it looks to me like we're making a little bit of progress.
We'll get this damn thing solved.
So let me phrase it. Let me try to put the question this way. Is the blame the employee mentality a necessary side effect of behavioral approaches, or is it the result of not doing the implementation of the behavioral method properly?
It's not understanding what behavioral science, or we call it behavior-based safety, it's not understanding the intention and the principles behind it. When you don't understand that, you might end up blaming the worker.
But I'm concerned, Scott, that after listening to what you have just said, if I'm a senior leader and I'm a bit naive about this stuff, uh-huh. I might well come away from our discussion thinking, okay, we just got to be smarter about how we control the behavior. Rather than thinking we got to be smarter about system effects, we got to actually look deeper than the behavior and say, what was going on in the environment? Was there a compensation system?
Sure.
Was there a
sure.
Had maintenance been deferred on that equipment for a
sure.
long time? Were there factors that impinged that actually encouraged the thing to happen that happened? The biggest problem I have coaching senior executives is getting them to see that.
Well,
they don't see that. They want to tell you, they want to say, I'm just frustrated because I can't get this behavior right. And I don't know why we can't. And if we could just do that, it would all be fixed.
And the term control behavior gets into that mindset.
Yeah.
When in fact, as Todd, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but
right.
you're going to say
yeah,
that
no.
the system is influencing the behavior. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, your question is really an important question. When I hear a senior leader say, why don't these guys behave differently? Why aren't my guys safer? How could that guy be so stupid? First rule of the oil patch, never put your head in front of a pressure vessel. You guys have heard all these things. That's data. That's data to us. In this room, that's information. Because what that tells me is that in that organization for that leader, he sees safety as a problem of his workforce. And so the next conversation we have to have with them is really not pushing accountability for safety down to the coalface. Mm-hmm. It's actually pulling accountability up. And the challenge I have is that behavioral-based safety tends to look at accountability as a backwards-looking value. It becomes a metric. I can count the number of safe and unsafe behaviors. Where I would suggest accountability is really more of a forward-looking value. That really, when you think about it, I think about it like this. I count on my guys doing good work, and they count on me to put them in a system where good work can happen. That sense of shared accountability, that's where those leaders, they're sort of crying for help when they say that to you, Tom. They're sort of saying, I'm frustrated because the tools that I thought have worked so well for so long no longer have the same efficacy that they once had.
They don't think they're crying for help.
Well, I think that's your job.
I think they are.
But that's your job, Tom.
Of course.
You're the one that's in there. I mean, the first time you have a senior leader, and probably everyone in this room has had this, have a senior leader look you in the eye and say, I don't have confidence we won't have an accident tomorrow. Right? When they say that to us, what they're saying is teach me.
Yep.
Help me learn. Because what I've thought of traditionally managing safety, follow the rules, be obedient, exercise good behavior, care more,
yep.
It doesn't seem to stop a fatality. I mean, if you think about it, and I'd really tell you guys that this is our challenge, is that workers always complete our systems. So the best procedure in the world is insufficient. We count on workers taking that procedure, that lockout tagout rule, into the field and using it in an adaptive variable environment. Workers complete the plan. We need to ask them not how can we get you to behave better. We need to ask them, what do you need in order to do this job in a way that if it fails, it fails as gracefully and as safely as it possibly can.
So here's a question that I think is a really good one from the audience.
Sure.
Can we move past theory to application? How would an analysis, yeah. How would an analysis look different under each practice?
I think that's you guys. Sorry, I hate to break it down.
I'll have a go at it. It's like, you know, so how would it look different under each practice? I can speak most directly to HOP and a little bit about our behavior-based safety experience. Let me come at it this way. When we think about these leaders, big operational leaders got there because they were usually good at two things. Fixing things and doing it fast. And the first thing they're going to tend to be able to find every time is that somebody didn't do what they wanted them to do. So they're going to have a tendency to go, I got it, I can react to that. Our job is to help them understand there's a deeper story. I think the HOP principles of that deeper story, the context, gave our leaders, so I'm just speaking to our experience now, it gave, by giving them that coaching, that perspective, we were able to give them something that they could kind of feel like they could get their arms around and go, yeah, there's something more to learn. And I need to go to the employees to be able to learn that. You know, my team and I need to be able to go to the employees and be able to learn that. That was incredibly important. Now, Todd talks a little bit about capacity, and that might be worth a comment here. Because I think that's where this discussion takes you. It's the outcome that looks different at the end of the day. And I think it gets down to the capacity comes to me in two parts. It's the organizational willingness and knowledge that they have to ask those new questions, react well and ask those new questions to get to that deeper story. That's part of it. I think the more important part of it is it gets down to it's how we design work, how we defend work, and we do it in conjunction with employees. And I'm going to throw in the example that I mentioned to you earlier, Tom, because I think it might be illustrative here. When you talk about capacity at this level with the worker, it's the capacity to fail safely, recover, and then complete what you wanted to do. Okay? And let me give you an example. Thinking electrical safety. I think most of us would click very quickly to working de-energized makes lockout tagout really important. It's the gold standard. Okay? So we teach our people. We hire smart people. We train the people. We watch them periodically when a supervisor walks around. Maybe we have peers look. There's a whole lot of things that we do. But what do we find? You've probably all seen, well, we could have somebody goes, I didn't do lockout tagout, I forgot. They could go, I didn't think lockout tagout was needed in this particular situation. They could take the equipment-specific lockout tagout procedure and they could make an error in execution so they don't get it done right. Or in look-alike equipment world, which is not all that uncommon, they could execute that procedure perfectly on the wrong piece of equipment, any of which presents a potentially deadly situation. They all are errors. They failed. The workers fail. So when we talk with our workers, one of the interesting things about new technology that I think helps us think about how can we create that landing spot to fail safely. Some of the new wearable sensor technologies, I think, are going to really help in this arena. You get the right sensor calibrated for the right level of electrical energy that you think you're going to be working on. You think you've gone and done the de-energization, you've locked it out, and as you approach the equipment, this thing starts vibrating, squawking. However the alarm is set up, it goes, whoa, wait a minute, there's a problem. There's still electricity here. There's still voltage here. The worker failed, but they're able to fail safely, realize they need to go back and do something different, they can recover, and now they can move forward and complete the work.
So that's a really interesting and helpful example. Tell us more about what you folks at GE did. So when you say you did HOP, what does that mean? What did you actually do? Was it at the site level? Was it at the business unit level? Was it a cascaded down training approach?
When we talked to some of the leaders in the field, Todd, amongst some others initially, we were told, you got to start at the very top. You got to get the big kahuna to say, we're all going to go do this. We quickly realized that the culture of our company was that was never ever going to happen. Okay, things didn't evolve that way in our company. What we needed to do was go create some success stories at the grassroots level, and then gain some operational leaders whose operations were affected by those success stories, and then let them help champion it, push it uphill, and eventually you start bringing more and more people to it. But make no mistake, to do HOP is to suggest that it's a program that at a point in time you go, I'm done. It's neither of those. It's an ongoing process. It's not a program. It's really an operating philosophy. It's a way that we teach operational leaders, maybe most importantly, the first thing is how you react to a failure that you didn't want is going to mean everything to your ability to now go learn deeply about it. Because if you allow the flash of anger, everybody knows what could come. To your point, if they fired the person already, nobody's going to talk.
And how have you assessed your success? On what basis have you determined that you're making progress or you're not making progress?
On a variety of levels. Most of them are highly subjective because we fought hard against the request. GE is metrics nuts, shall we say. They wanted us to measure anything and everything. And I finally ended up in a discussion with folks that we're just not going to do it. We don't. So there are a lot softer measures. And you watch and you see when significant events do happen. How did it unfold? How did leadership respond? Did they want to fire the person? Did we have to intervene and try to say, hey, look, there's information you need before that's even a decision you should take on? Or did they react in a favorable way, ask for help, start to get the right kinds of questions asked, bring the employees in, get that group thoroughly involved in the process? We try to measure it on, are we seeing those kinds of things? Now, unquestionably, at the end of the day, there's a question of performance. And ultimately, do you see improvements in, you know, going down on the rates? But yes, not the general rates, though. That's not the target. We're really thinking about the more significant events.
So everybody's these days talking about serious injuries and fatalities.
Yeah, FSIs and SIFs. A lot of
interest in serious injuries and fatalities for really good reason, in my judgment. Tell us about your history with serious injuries and fatalities. You're 400,000 employees globally.
Yeah.
An incredible number.
Yeah.
Tell us about the number of fatal events that you've had and the history of those.
If you go back 10, 15, 20 years, you would find a lot of numbers in the teens per year, employee and contractor fatalities. You'd find one or two that were spiked higher than that, but you know there was a plane crash or something like that that spiked it, which is kind of hard to influence in some cases. We're to the point now where we're typically down in, right now we're running at around one recently on employee side.
On contractors?
On the contractors, it's more of a challenge because you're not at sites that you always control completely. So there we've had a higher number. We're around five right now, I believe, is the number. So in the last year. So that's a concern to us.
400,000 people.
400,000 people. Still five too many, and I know you know. I know you're on the same page with me.
Way too many, but as a rate, which is not the right way to think about the fatal event, because it's a human being.
Right.
But it's a good. You have to measure success, and five on 400,000 is as good as anyone that I know. Right. I don't know anybody who's doing better than that.
So you know, we feel it's helped us make demonstrable improvements. We see that projects field away from your own home facilities. Aspect, it's more challenging. So we're still struggling with that in some respects. But that's where we are.
Well, one of the things that shifted in the way GE thinks about fatalities, and I got to tell you guys, fatalities is a whole nother one of these panels, is that this new view using HOP, they really expect accidents. They expect failure to happen as opposed to imagining they can prevent accidents. So it's a real, it's a philosophical shift. Kurt spoke to it. It's the realization that you can't manage uncertainty. And so if you can't manage uncertainty, you use certain ideas to manage uncertain outcomes. And so where GE really switched, and it was a pretty hard journey for them, was they got off the fact that all accidents are preventable, and they got onto the fact that, in fact, accidents are accidents. They're unintentional deviations from outcomes. They're accidents, right? And that what we have to do is be prepared for that accident and manage and mitigate the consequence. That shift in thinking is probably, my guess, where we need to be kind of moving these serious events, because you probably can't prevent a fatality because fatalities live in successful work. Well, actually, let me say this. I think you're really good at preventing fatalities. You probably can't predict a fatality because fatalities exist in successful work. So the best you can hope for is to mitigate and control. And that's made a huge difference for GE.
Can I get,
please,
I want to just get practical for a second. That's great philosophy, and it sounds great. But I want to know, what do I do? So I'm going to tell you, behavior-based safety is what you would do if you did it right. Not the way Todd defined it, but the way you do it right. Well, let's talk about it, Todd.
I'm not wrong.
You kind of indicated that the checklist is about counting up behaviors. That's part of it, but it's also looking at the system. When I'm observing a critical list of behaviors, and the better they connect to potential fatalities, the better off my list, I'm looking at system. I'm looking at environmental factors that are facilitating at-risk behavior, or environmental factors that could facilitate safe behavior if they were only there. So part of that analysis, and it's not an investigation, please, is an analysis to find out what is out there. And guess what? The reason behavior-based safety was so very successful in the beginning, it involved the worker. For the first time, workers got involved with deciding what should we be doing to be safe. And now, but to do it right, by the way, the most important part that's missing in most of the behavior-based safety stuff that I've seen is that conversation between peers or between a supervisor and a peer and a worker about, and it is caring. It's demonstrating that I care about your safety, and we have a non-directive conversation. We're calling it humanistic behaviorism. We're having a non-directive conversation where I ask more questions because I want to learn. And Kurt, you said, I want to learn, mm-hmm. but I need to know what to learn about. And the people on the job are out there finding us data, and it's beyond the numbers game. We know that behavioral data is unreliable, it's not valid, but it's that other stuff. It's the system stuff that we can learn about from the worker.
So can I ask a question?
No.
Okay.
I think he's
really
going to
super
anyway.
Good. Yeah. I don't have to ask it.
Before you ask your question, I wanted to talk. You know, one of the real successes that we had with getting our craft to really own our safety program was around, and we call it mining the diamond, but around our significant injuries and fatality prevention approach. And it was just that. It was the getting them together. And we every one of our jobs now has what we call craft voice and safety, or the CIVIS team. And they meet together on their own, and then they talk directly with the project management on the group about, hey, these are the issues we're seeing, these are the things we ought to be doing about it. And where it's really valuable is when the project management is asking that team, what are the problems we're seeing, what are the solutions you guys are suggesting? And then when they take those solutions and put them in place, then the trust all of a sudden starts. And really our biggest issue is, how do we communicate that this is happening to the rest of the job site so everybody else starts to feel that same trust?
I think that's really helpful. Please ask your question.
Well, so the question I'd want to ask Scott, because I think this is kind of thinking I've been having recently, because I've looked at a bunch of events. If the things that hurt people are the things that kill people, then I think the method you're talking about is pretty good. But what I'm finding is the things that kill people are almost never the things that hurt people. So we've probably had very few employees die of ankle sprains, right? I mean, they're hardly. In fact, I was going through my Rolodex. I don't remember any fatal ankle sprains, unless you guys have them out there. So tracking the things that hurt people seems valuable, and I think it is valuable for sort of the total reportable and the OSHA numbers. But it seems like the disconnect with the fatality stuff is that fatalities happen in places where we don't have injury. Does that make sense? Because I'd be curious what you think about it.
So the worker did not tie off, and this is a real case, did not tie off and he fell to his death.
Right.
Another worker noticed he did not tie off and he didn't say anything.
Right.
That suggests to me we have a problem. We have a lack of people realizing that we have to, the silent majority needs to speak up. Those workers, the two workers who saw him and didn't say anything, they're living with that now for the rest of their
life. Yeah, because I would tell you that the worker who didn't say anything is not a bad guy. He's a victim.
Yeah,
that he's a part of a culture that wouldn't allow him to speak up. I mean, I'd have to understand that, but saying had they cared more, that event wouldn't have happened. I mean, I think that's true. It's just incredibly difficult to manage.
Well,
that.
And you're absolutely right. And the challenge is to develop the kind of culture where the person would speak up, the kind of culture where people will talk about their injuries. You know, some organizations, and Charlie Moorcraft and Tony Crow and these folks who have been injured, and they bring them into our organizations to get us emotionally involved. Wouldn't it be nice if we had employees willing to speak up about their injuries, about their close calls, and get that conversation going instead of stifling it? And then maybe I'm more comfortable at speaking up. But that's what we have to have happen.
Here's a great question from the audience. Can you ask Todd and Scott to state two things they like about the other person's approach?
Scotty.
Or things they learned that might influence the way they look at their own approach. Somebody was listening.
Let me start
there.
I'll,
that was
go
a
ahead.
Great
I'll
question.
Start. I'll start. So I with a celebratory heart, I will tell you that the reason I can have the discussion I'm having with you right now is because Scott had the discussion around these topics earlier, and that I will, to my dying day, believe that part of our ability to mature as a profession is based upon these little milestones that we go through. And I think we could not have the choice discussion we were having if we hadn't at some point in some time really taken to this behavioral-based safety idea and run it carefully through our systems as a maturation point. I think that's remarkable. And I will never, ever not admit that I stand on the shoulders of giants, and that the new ideas that we have really are sort of matured ideas that are taken from the seeds that were planted earlier.
That's one.
Two. You know the other thing? Scott looks good in a sport coat.
I got nothing to say. Well,
you can change behavior.
I do, man. I do. First, it's been my frustration that early on, in fact, my first book was 1996, and I taught much about what you're teaching back then. Behavior-based safety wasn't about a checklist and checking off behaviors. It was about actively caring. It's about the human dynamic, which is broader than just defining behaviors. It's more than that. But what I'm learning from you and appreciating from you is that you do see the bigger picture. You do see it's a system, and you're teaching people that. But no offense, but you don't recognize the fact that...
No, this isn't the criticize time.
No.
No, this is... Stay on task.
We were that
Wait,
way.
Hold it, you guys. Scott, I'm seeing an at-risk behavior here.
See, I can't
I
compete
with
that. I want
to actively care and coach
with,
you into a more positive approach.
Behavior-based safety, what people did is they took it and they made it simple. The engineers wanted numbers. And they didn't use all of the human dynamics involved, which included concepts like choice, you know? But they dropped that out, and it became efficient over effective, and thus we've drifted. We've drifted away from the way it was initially taught. And so you're right. We have drifted, and you're drifting us back. We're using different language. I think we're after the same thing. Performance is the outcome of the system. I think we're after the same thing, man. See?
Okay, here, let me go a different direction slightly. We've got 7 minutes left to go, and we've got a couple of questions here I want to ask as well. Is the role of leadership similar or different in the two approaches?
You looking at me? Are you looking?
I don't care.
Different.
Sure.
Different.
And is that it?
Do you want more?
I think you want to say more.
No, I mean, I'll totally say more. I think what's happening is that the realization that the leader is really accountable for the operational reliability at all levels is becoming really, really quite profound. I think we've made some mistakes organizationally. I don't know if we've made mistakes personally, but organizationally, whereas I think the leader has assigned safety. They see safety as an outcome. Go out and fix safety. I mean, that's what we do for a living. And I think that philosophical shift in really how they see the worker and how they define safety. I will just tell you, I think our definition of safety is wrong. I think it's not wrong. I think it's old. I think the best thing we can do ever is to help our leadership understand that they don't manage the absence or presence of accidents. They actually manage their company's capacity to actually do high-risk work safely.
But to answer that question, I think, yes, the leadership role is exactly the same if you're doing it right in either system, right? You're still trying to facilitate climate. You're still trying to look at the, you know, what are the pressures that the folks are in. You're neither system is looking to blame the employee for do what they did. It's more what is, you know, the systems we put in place, have we built this environment, are we giving them the right tools to be successful? And when the managers and when the leaders in the company look at it that way, you'll be successful using either system, and I think both systems actually start to look a lot alike at that point too.
Here's what we teach, however. Everybody can be a leader. Managers hold us accountable. Leaders inspire us to be self-accountable. And so when I think the word leadership, it means everybody. And we want to teach people to step to the plate and inspire people to do their best for safety. And that gets back to what we talked about earlier, when the person should say to that person, I wish you would tie off. That would be leadership. So leadership is, and there's ways to teach people what to do, how to do that, but we can all be, those people out there, they can all be leaders for safety. But there are managers, and that maybe we want to say management has changed.
Our biggest shift in the past is really based on taking a look at the incidents that have occurred, but looking at the potential versus the actual outcome, right? And then reacting the right way based on that. Our big challenge right now is how do we push this role for our supervisors? What are they supposed to do, right? What are their behaviors? How do they drive the things we've been talking about today? And you know, you talk about leaders asking for help. That's where we really kind of struggle, even at our district leadership. They don't quite know how to get their supervisors to go do these things that we want them to do. And so, you know, that's really what our big focus is now, is trying to get our supervisors. Craft ownership is great because we push this, all of our safety processes down to our craft employees, but then our superintendents kind of sit back and go, all right, well, what am I supposed to do? Or in worst cases, walk away from it completely.
Okay. Kurt? Yeah, let me just talk to our experience with it. I mean, I'm not going to debate the academics between Todd and Scott. Just let me.
Why not?
No. No.
Dance with the person who brought you.
That's okay? Right.
That's all I'm saying.
That's true. That's a whole different mind picture. Thank you very much. No. Our experience with it is this. And maybe it's that we drifted in the application. When we were using behavior-based safety, okay, we found it would spool up, be effective, and then spool down, usually in a period of 2, maybe 3 years. Okay, and oftentimes we ended up worse than where we had started. Management seemed to quickly default back to that, very quick, focus on the employee, and that was where they reacted, and they didn't seem to find the answers, at least in the way we were doing it, that solved that problem. Whereas almost 9 years later in HOP, we haven't seen that effect. It feels like we're able to give them something that they're able to hang on to and say, all right, I've learned to be different. Now, we may have new managers come in when we acquire a company, which we do a few times a year. And so that affects the culture. And we always feel like we're maybe taking 2 steps forward and 1 step back, bringing new people up to speed. But our experience feels different.
Okay, that's helpful. This is a question from the audience. Is there a natural progression from one process to the next?
For us, it was a break. I mean, there was a period of time where we tried using one, and we couldn't seem to get over the hump. And then we went on a search for a few years of looking for, all right, what else is out there? What can we get our hands on? It did not feel like a progression. Now, I'm listening to what Scott and Todd are talking about. Maybe there is one. I don't know. But it didn't feel like one to us. It felt like we changed and did something different.
Okay. This is probably our last question. What would you say to an organizational leader that was considering starting an initiative to address the human side of safety performance? Start, Scott.
Just a quick point. I'm so glad we're starting to use the word actively caring over behavior-based safety, because behavior-based safety has that baggage. But I would say people need to understand that it is about actively caring. We all care. We're talking about acting on that caring. And we have to teach them the principles behind it, which includes understanding the system. And it includes conversations which are non-directive and non-threatening. It includes trust. It includes developing a culture where people truly do look out for each other. It's a brothers, sisters, keepers culture.
I think I would tell them to read, to research, to analyze, to look for peer companies that are doing it differently and ask questions of their peers, executive to executive. Mm-hmm. I think I agree with Kurt that the real shift in the leadership is a shift in how they perceive the employee. If you perceive the employee as something that needs to be fixed, it's not going to be a very smooth maturation process. But I think there's lots and lots of really, really great stuff out there. Lots and lots of really exciting things going on. I would look to that and learn from success.
Okay, Eric?
The question I usually ask when somebody brings it up to me is, you know, do the folks that report to you, the people that you're responsible for, do they think that their safety is the most important thing to you? And if you're not sure whether or not they think that, you probably have some work to do.
Okay.
I think the first question I'd ask them is if they're ready and willing to hear that they need to give up some old practices that they've probably learned in school, practiced for a long time, and they're going to have to step away from. And if they are, we've got some things that we can show them. I think doing a little reading, going and talking to some peer leaders in other companies that are trying it, all of the right things. But if they're not ready to hear, you might have to give up some old practices that just aren't going to be sustainable. Then you've got a problem. You're not ready to have that conversation yet.
Okay. We're out of time. I want to thank you guys. I think you did a terrific job.
Again, special thanks to ASSE. If you haven't seen this, it's available on YouTube, so it's widely available. I'm not worried about that. But they did do all the putting together of this, and it was a really interesting day. It was good. I mean, it was really good. There were a ton of people there. It was crazy how many people were in that room. And I actually felt like it was probably a really good use of my time. I was glad to be a part of it. I was glad to get to say what I got to say. And I was glad to sort of be in dialogue with these guys, because I think that's how this game is won or lost, is by talking to each other, and we got to talk to each other more. That's for sure. Hey, I hope you enjoyed this. Have a great day, will you? I hope you get what you need. That's important. Learn something new every single day. I bet you did today. Have as much fun as you possibly can. And for goodness sakes, be safe.